Working Cows Podcast, Episode 21.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
This episode has been brought to you by Chris Williams Audio. Check out his website at chriswilliamsaudio.com. For the last 11 years or so, I've been talking for a living. I've gained some skills in talking. I can form a sentence. I can think on my feet. I can respond to questions. I can come up with new questions. All that time developing my speaking craft has not left me a lot of time to figure out how to make audio sound great. If you're a musician, podcaster, or filmmaker, making your product sound great is crucial. So you stick to what you know, and let Chris Williams stick to what he knows, making your product sound great. Head on over to chriswilliamsaudio.com for all your podcasting, music production, and film audio needs.
I have a confession to make. That's how I start conversations with my wife when I have something inane to confess, like I used the last roll of toilet paper and I didn't replace it, or I drank some milk from the jug out of the fridge and put it back in without the lid. So, here I am, confessing to you, the listeners of the Working Cows podcast, that I am in the cage stage of my learning process in the grazing field. What the heck is a cage stage, you might ask? Well, there's a theologian that I listen to, a guy by the name of James White, and he talks about certain theological persuasions having a cage stage, where it would be better for everyone, those who are proponents of that theological persuasion, and those who are engaged in debates or opponents of that theological persuasion, if that person who was new to this way of thinking was just locked in a cage for a while, where they couldn't attack people with their newfound passion for the knowledge. So, I am in the cage stage when it comes to my learning about grazing. What we have here today is my appearance on a podcast of a guy that I have met through a Facebook group of podcasters where we get together and we help each other with different things. And I joined him for a discussion, and this was a free-flowing discussion, and it touches on some ag advocacy things and some different things, and I didn't exactly nail it in some regards. One thing in particular I touched on, I didn't feel I did a great job of answering that question, mostly due to the fact that I am in the cage stage of the grazing learning process. So I hope that you will overlook some of that and just engage with this content for what it is, a free-flowing discussion between two guys. Another thing I will say is that I had the opportunity to go back and make this a little bit more palatable for different audiences, but what Sean is doing with his podcast, the Come to the Table podcast, is important, and specifically what he's doing in regards to authenticity is important. And so you get this raw as it was presented, as it was recorded, and I don't have anything to say in by way of defense of myself other than that I'm in the cage stage of learning these grazing principles, and sometimes I get a little excited and I give them credit for being able to accomplish things and solve problems facing producers that maybe they can't, or even solve problems that are facing the world. But you know what? I think I'm in good company, and I think that there is a necessary discussion to be had as far as adapted animals. And episode 25, I have scheduled a discussion with Kit Farrow for episode 25 that I think will help move that conversation of animals adapted to the climate that they are in a little bit farther down the road. So just stick with me, and we will continue with more episodes engaging with producers next week. Episode 22 with Cody McDaniel talking about his move from Kansas up to Montana and some of the different challenges that he's run into there and some of the things that he's doing to quit the herd, so to speak, as will become a recurring topic on the Working Cows podcast, just based on the fact that I am talking to cooperative program producers for Faro Cattle Company. So this is my appearance on the Come to the Table podcast with Sean McCoy. Before we get into that, though, I would like to tell you about a new sponsor here on the Working Cows podcast. That is the High Plains Ranch Practicum. And I guess if you want to blame somebody for me being in the cage stage of learning the grazing principles, you could blame the High Plains Ranch Practicum. You could blame Dallas Mount, Aaron Berger, Blake Hopman, the instructors of the High Plains Ranch Practicum. It is an invaluable resource. I cannot stress highly enough how much I think it is important for producers to be involved in continuing education programs. So please take advantage of this opportunity and go check out the High Plains Ranch Practicum at hpranchpracticum.com and engage with the materials there and register. The class that I was a part of sold out before the deadline, and so the deadline is the end of May. But go ahead and register early and make plans to be a part of this. Just a great format for continuing education for ranchers. HPRanchPracticum.com, our newest sponsor on the Working Cows podcast. So I have rambled on long enough. Without further ado, this is my appearance on the Come to the Table podcast with Sean McCoy. Please enjoy this free-flowing discussion.
Welcome to another episode of the Come to the Table podcast. And as always, I say this every time, but I really am not only excited to be here, excited about the guests that I have on, but as things have progressed in this entire podcast journey, again, it's just been a humbling experience. And this next guest is an example of that. Having met Clay through a Facebook group, as I've mentioned in other ones, and how we got connected that way. But more importantly, it's a testament to the beauty of the podcast industry and how there's so many different podcasts out there. Clay has a podcast called the Working Cows Podcast. And yes, it is exactly that. It's about working cows. It's not an homage. It's not a tribute to something else. It is actually about working cows. And so I listened to an episode of his, and it was the best stuff for 2017. And I thought, you know what? Let's have a conversation. It was just on my heart, and so I reached out to Clay, and he was kind enough to respond back to me. He's here with us today, and Clay, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Sean. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited about the opportunity to have a conversation with you.
Yes, sir, I am too. So we're going to start out with just jumping right into the bio, into the questions, so we can get that going. It's a bit of an homage to one of my favorite podcasts, after the Team Never Quit podcast, as I've mentioned before, with Marcus Luttrell and David Rutherford. And so here we go, buddy. We're gonna go through this. And so the bio I sent to Clay before, and where were you born and where did you grow up? Clay was born in Rapid City, South Dakota. He grew up also in Belfourche. Is that the right way to say that?
I always say the rednecks around here pronounce it Belfourche.
Belfourche. All right. It's worth to me. In South Dakota, 5 to 10 miles from his house is where my parents were living when he was born. And so obviously from the great state of South Dakota. And so is there – South Dakota, I remember you guys are famous for the pheasants and pheasant hunting. I love to
yes,
hunt.
Yes, sir.
Did you hunt pheasant a lot growing up? Or is it something you always got to do?
So South Dakota, we talk about kind of there being two different Dakotas, East and West South Dakota. And actually there was a legislator from North Dakota that wanted to make it East and West Dakota and just join the – north and south portions of the western parts of North and South Dakota. So anyways, they're just so much different in their economies and everything. So the pheasant hunting happens in eastern South Dakota, but I did travel and do my fair share of pheasant hunting. Been a while since I've been back there to do that, but yeah, it's a ton of fun.
It's my favorite hunting. I just absolutely love it because you get to do it with people. We usually go to Kansas. I've been wanting to go to South Dakota. That's one of those bucket list items. And just something about driving the birds and having we use a guide and a group in Kansas there, and the German Shorthair pointers come out, and you're walking with your buddies, and it's just a beautiful experience. So that's awesome. So that's a little bit of trivia that I had no idea. So there was an opportunity, maybe, or a thought of, instead of North and South, it could have been East and West Dakota. That's kind of cool. That's
interesting. Yeah, and actually, that wasn't that long ago, and I don't know how serious that was, but the suggestion was definitely floated.
So we'll have Texas will succeed. You guys can go to East West. California will become its own nation as well. It will be a good time. We'll be had by all. So where do you currently live, and where have you lived before? You had Belfouche, South Dakota, and then Waukesha, Wisconsin as well. How long were you there in Wisconsin?
I went to 2 years of Bible school.
Was that right after high school, or was that?
Yep. I graduated high school in 2003 and straight to Bible school the next fall of 2003, September of 2003.
So his dad worked for Northwestern Bell, which is part of US West Quest, and now is CenturyLink. Your dad's still working for them?
No, sir. He retired, I believe, in 2008, maybe. I think it was 2008.
And then your mom's an elementary school teacher. So just a beautiful, typical Midwest family, huh?
Yes, sir. Yep.
And they ranch together full time. Your parents do that?
Yep. That's what they kind of spent their years working town jobs, as we would say around here, to pay for the land that they now run their cow herd on, or a portion of it.
It's definitely a family affair, then. Is that something they just always wanted to do?
Yeah, I think my dad's actually owned cows since he was 19. I have started now in my own cow herd. He started with a milk cow and bucket calves and raised them up, and I don't know if they sold them and bought a cow or if they turned them into the cows in their own herd. But, yeah, I think since he was 19, he's owned cows.
Wow. And so you're married to your best friend for 11 years. Awesome. And you have four beautiful kiddos, three boys and a girl, all under the age of 9. So you have your hands full.
Yes. Yes, sir. Yep. I said the other day in a sermon, I have not been bored in 9 years. So
yeah, no, I have one 6-year-old and the other two are older. So I have no doubt. I'm sure it's never a dull moment, but the days go by slow and the years go by fast. That's for sure, right?
I have not heard that before, but yeah, it's accurate to this point for sure. We're halfway to an 18-year-old, my wife and I. She shed a tear. I might have celebrated a little, but you know how that goes.
Oh, I do. Yeah, it's that. And it's, you know, it goes by so fast, and you start looking at it, and somebody starts, our youth minister the other day was telling us about how many more, based on your kid's age, how many more Christmases you have and how many more weekends you have, and it's, you kind of start thinking about it, like, wow, that's not a whole lot of time. And so it's a little scary, it's a little humbling, for sure. Yeah.
That's a brutal way of looking at it, yeah.
So I think it was part of the motivation to get us to kind of come help the youth ministry, which we're like, all right, here we go. So, good stuff. So the humble brag is we like to ask, and so he said, preaching is the only thing I've ever been good at, but that he also is able to keep cool in heated conversations, which I thought was an interesting humble brag. So tell us a little bit more about that. Is that something you've just always been able to do?
I didn't notice until I started working in a church, and working in a church, as you may or may not know, will lead to some heated conversations here and there. I've seen a lot of people just immediately almost go to defensiveness or personally offended. It just hasn't been my nature, I guess, and I don't know if that has something to do with the fact that I'm probably a coward at heart, that I would rather avoid the confrontation. But really, I love to have a conversation, and I love to seek understanding with the person. Yeah, I don't know if that's because I want to make them happy or I just legitimately want them to understand me and I want to understand them. But that's kind of my experience thus far.
I would lean a little bit more towards the latter because I think it's easier to just get angry and let your emotions fly. And that's, you know, there's a discipline there that it takes to have that compassion for the other side. And it's, you know, I would say the much more, I don't think that makes you a coward, my friend, not by any stretch. And so I just want to clarify. So you're telling me that in a church, not everybody gets along. Is that what you just said? I just want to make sure we...
Hard as it may be to believe, I'm sure that nobody out there has that experience. I'm just in a unique situation. But, yeah, that has been my experience.
Well, there you go. Clay, you managed to get the one church in all of the world that has conflict because I'm pretty sure the rest of them just all roses and praise and all the rest of this stuff. So, well, at least they have a good guy who has an even keel and a cool head in there.
Well, I'll bear that mantle, I guess, if it's helping the rest of you.
Attaboy. Well, I do definitely appreciate the conversation side, and it leads into why you're here quite a bit. And so we've changed the format just a little bit from what you probably heard on the first couple of podcasts. I have the five questions, but for the first three, what I'm going to ask you to do is pick a number 1, 2, or 3, and then whichever one of those questions you pick, I'm going to ask you, but I'm not going to tell you what they are beforehand. So pick a number 1, 2, or 3, my friend.
Middle of the road, 2.
When was the last time you slept more than 9 hours.
Oh, man. I've had kids for 9 years. Probably the last time I was sick. I tend to do this thing where I don't get sick for like 2, 3, 4 years, and then I'll just get really sick, and I'll spend 17 hours in bed. So I think that the most recent time that happened was in 2016. So,
and I figured between you being a rancher and having kids under the age of 9, that would be that might take you a few minutes to think about. But, yeah, because there's 9 hours is a long time. If you have kids out there, you know that it's not something that happens all the time, that's for sure.
Interesting part of that is the kid that will fight you tooth and nail to get out of bed and go to school every day of the week is, in my experience anyways, the first one out of bed on Saturday when everybody could be sleeping in.
Always. It's always that. You're just like, what are you – I had to drag my 14-year-old son out of bed, and then Saturday at 6:30 he's knocking on the door asking us what we're doing. It's like, well, I'm sleeping. That's what – at least I was. So, yeah, no, it's a universal truth, my friend, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, good. I'm at least I'm not alone in that. I appreciate that.
No doubt. So the next two are kind of the standard ones. The first one is, what is your personal faith or belief system?
I belong to Jesus.
Born and raised in that, or was it, you might tell us a little bit more about that, about your walk?
I would say I grew up in a nominally Christian home. My parents, we went to church every once in a while. I have heard through the grapevine that God providing the funds for me to attend a Christian boarding high school my senior year of high school was kind of what led my parents to faith in Christ. I've never heard them personally share that story, but I've heard that from other people who have heard them share their testimony. A fun fact about that is I was counseling at a Rick and Mick event. I don't know if you've ever heard of Rick and Mick, but they travel and do comedy and sketches and then share the gospel. And I was counseling there, the altar call, and we were supposed to get up and walk down kind of staggered as the counselors. And as I got up to walk down, my mom was walking down to respond to the altar call at the same time. I looked over and she was walking down the aisle to respond at the same time I was going down to counsel. So it was a fascinating, unique experience.
I'm sure very humbling as far as having that experience with your mom. And that. So did you guys ever talk about it later and ask her what made her do at that point or have any kind of reflection on that?
Yeah, I was pretty radical when I first became a Christian. And so I was, you know, kind of the Bible-thumping wing nut continually kind of throwing it in my family's face. And a wise lady who was at that point kind of my main discipler said, you know, just live your Christian life in front of them and let them see you live it out and they'll come around. And so I took that to heart and I started doing that. It wasn't too long after that my mom responded. And I kind of more from the approach, I think the only conversation we've ever had about it was that I basically quizzed her to make sure that she understood what was going on, which was, you know, typical 17-year-old kid or 16-year-old kid, kind of not really giving mom the credit she deserved for being able to use her own rational faculties. But, you know.
Well, humility is definitely part of that walk, right? And it seems like you definitely had that experience. And so could you mind me touching base a little bit more about what you just said? Because it really piqued my interest about kind of that initial self-righteous, almost kind of like, I have this new power to go out and talk about the gospel, so let me go out and tell everybody what they need to do. That's kind of what you said, right?
Yeah, I specifically remember a conversation on the way home from somewhere, and we were talking about the end times, you know, as you would predict a new believer would be on fire about having a conversation about that. And my brother was kind of slapping his hands together in the back like this Bible thumper, you know. And so, you know, that was just kind of that passion, I guess, is what it was. But it was maybe a little bit misguided, I suppose.
So would you say that? Because I think that's kind of an important point. I'd love to touch base on that a little bit before we get started on the subject. But I think that's an important thing to put out there to the world about how in my experience as well, there's so many well-intended people who I think become on fire, as you said, and become very, very just passionate about their faith. And so the first thing you want to do when you're passionate about anything, it could be maybe it's a great restaurant or it's anything that you become passionate about, typically people want to share that. And so when it comes to something like your faith and salvation and all of that, there seems to be a natural proclivity to go out and want to share it with everybody, but not everybody's listening. is in tune, or even the delivery can be a little bit well-intended but not necessarily come across very well.
Yeah, I think that there's that tendency early as a believer, as a Christian, to think that it's all up to you. You know, that you're this, as I've heard said, you're a commando Christian, and you're the only hope that this person has for being saved, rather than looking at it from a biblical perspective that would tell you that you are planting a seed, somebody else is going to come along and water it, and God is going to give the increase. It's ultimately God's responsibility to bring those things to fruition.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of subject matter we could talk about on that, and I think if we get some time here in a bit, let's definitely revisit that if it shows up. But I think to that, maybe the same time, I think the fifth question now is apropos in a sense of basically what I ask is, what belief system other than your own have you had, or are you familiar with, and what has been your impression of it?
You know, I'm in flyover country, so I haven't had a smack in the middle of it. I haven't had a lot of exposure to others. You know, I probably the most exposure I had to another world religion in its own context was I took a trip to Kenya in 2001 with a youth missions organization. And so I was exposed to Islam there. The year that I was there was, to my understanding, now this has been a while, but to my understanding, the year that I was there in Kenya was the first year that there were more Christians than Muslims in Kenya since, I don't know, the rise of Islam, I guess, would be the best way to say it. So that was probably the most, you know, I've been exposed to other ways of thinking and friends who have essentially, I believe, become Hindu and different things like that. But I would say that as far as exposure, probably Islam.
So Islam is always a lightning rod right now, definitely from a political standpoint, definitely from just our experiences, especially since 9/11 as a country. So with that year that you were there, 2001, I mean, were you there during September 11th?
So we flew back into JFK Airport in August of 2001. And, you know, I suppose I was there maybe a month to 25 days before 9/11 on my trip back from Kenya. So right there at the start of the school year, September 11th was happening.
So in your time frame while you were there in Kenya, did you, as you've seen Islam portrayed and as you've seen Muslims portrayed in the media, how did that line up with your experience?
You know, we didn't have a lot of opportunity to interact with people that we knew were Muslims before the conversation started, you know, and so there were some of those interactions that we experienced, and I could tell kind of an anecdotal story about that, but I don't know that it's helpful to the conversation. So I guess to me, the media should not shape our opinion towards Muslims. If I can climb up on a soapbox here,
sure.
The gospel should shape our opinion towards all people and how we treat them and how we love them and how we look at them. And they are a subject or an object of love first before they are a competing worldview or enemy combatant, if you will.
I will, and I think that's I love that answer. So okay, so that's a good segue that we can stop that there and go into the next one, which is, so part of the reason I asked Clay to come on here, a big part of the reason is around his profession and listening to his podcast about him being a cattle farmer or cattle rancher is the better way to say that. I'm sorry, but even that, and trying to understand, we look out into the world and we see all these conversations happening, or some of the information being portrayed around how beef is handled, how cattle are handled, how they're led to slaughter, how, you know, what's in our beef? They're full of antibiotics, or they're full of growth hormones, and we can't eat that, don't eat that, and how all these different things around those. And so, as far as an issue, and it's not to try to create a problem per se, it's just more of a idea of having a conversation around, okay, what's really going on in the cattle industry? And then after listening to his podcast, you know, the Working Cows podcast, I thought, let's talk a little bit more about what is it like to be a rancher now. What is it like in that world? How much does technology play a role? How much does the old school kind of thing is, you know, do you wear cowboy boots to work? And what is it really like? And the only, now I'm a Texan, I'm a proud Texan. Clay is very important to me, and I can wear cowboy boots and a belt buckle and a hat with the best of them. But if I'm being honest, I don't have any idea what to do on a ranch. I wouldn't have a clue how to ride a horse. I've been on them a couple of times. That's not my happy place. the best I can say about ranching, the closest I've ever been, is my oldest daughter. Her last two years of high school, she was an FFA. So I got to help raise a steer for a little bit. We actually had to, I know we can maybe talk about that some as if it comes up, but we had to give up on the steer. It was a Hereford steer, and it would not. My friend, it would not adhere. We couldn't break it. We couldn't do any of this stuff to it. And we actually ended up at a point where the FFA teacher, who was a legendary teacher for Fort Bend County, actually said that the last two options we had were to, one, tie it to a mule and take it out into the pasture to break it, or there was some shot that we could give it that would descramble its brain and then somehow, I guess, reset. And I was kind of like, when do we throw in the towel here? Because my wife was going in, you know, we're at an FFA barn, and for those who those that may not know, FFA is Future Farmers of America, so it's very much, it's real, you know, you're really working the cattle. So she ended up raising a couple of pigs instead and did really well in that area, but the steer was a big fat failure. So yeah, so that's kind of what we're going to talk about a little bit about the cattle ranching industry and Clay's experience on that. And what say you, my friend?
I've had that experience of trying to break a stubborn animal. I was in 4-H growing up, which is kind of a Boy Scout for rednecks, I guess, is how I usually describe it, except for they allow the girls in too. So boy and Girl Scouts for rednecks. So anyways, and we had to break them. And there were times where we might have tied a stubborn cow or stubborn steer or heifer to the back of a tractor and pulled her up and down the driveway a few times to get it through her head that this is fun and she's going to enjoy it, or he is going to enjoy it, and we will sell them for lots of money at the 4-H sale.
So to give a little perspective, because some people may hear that and think, well, see, there you go, there's the cruelty and you're dragging this animal around with a tractor. But kind of go to the essence of why that's something that you do and what that ultimately leads to.
It's just an opportunity to teach kids about caring for animals and discipline. And I know that sounds ironic given the story I told about dragging them around with the tractor. But we would never intentionally injure them or anything. It was just more, we can't move this animal on our own. And we're going to help them learn what we're asking them to do, because we're not big enough to help them learn how to do what we're asking them to do on our own. And so a lot of working with cows comes down to an issue of pressure, and kids are no different. And I'll tell you why I say that in a minute, but you put pressure on them until they do what you want to do. And then you relieve the pressure. That is something that once they start to step, once they start to walk and be led, then you will relieve that pressure and say, okay, that's what I wanted. Here's a reward, whether it's grain or what we call cake, which is just a protein pellet, a big one, big protein pellet, maybe 2 or 3 times the size of your thumb, if you want an idea of the scale of it. You give them a few of those or a handful of those, and just as a reward, you did what I wanted you to do. Now here's a reward, and tomorrow we're going to come back and we're going to do it again, and we're going to do it again until I can walk you in and out of a sale ring without getting me or somebody else run over. It's about developing a relationship with that animal where they trust you and you trust them. And I was probably, I'll say 10, and that's probably conservative. I might have started younger, between 10 and 15 years old when I was showing cows. You're turning a 10-year-old loose with a 700-pound steer or heifer and asking them to manage that animal. So there's got to be a big level of trust developed there where you are able to handle that animal at that age and not be putting you or other people in danger.
Well, you said the word relationship, which I think was really important. I remember watching the kids sleep sometimes in the pen over at the FFA barn. They'd sleep overnight, especially when they were going to show them. We'd get in there and literally lay down in the hay bale or the shavings and inside the pen with these animals. And so your that relationship you're talking about isn't just a do what I say relationship. There definitely takes on an emotional value to that, I would say, for you guys.
Totally. So the best illustration of that relationship that I can think of is in 2013, in October of 2013, so just over 4 years ago, we had the worst blizzard on record, I think, or maybe in the last 100 years. And what made that blizzard so bad is that the 2 days before that blizzard hit, it's called the Atlas Storm. You can look it up if you want to have your gut wrenched a little bit. 2 days before the Atlas blizzard hit, we got rain, and we got lots of rain, like a couple inches of rain. And here in western South Dakota, we get like 14 inches of rain a year. And so we got a couple of inches of rain in 2 days in October, and then we got 4 feet of snow, and it was heavy, wet snow on top of that. And western South Dakota lost massive amounts of cows in that. And this is an important part of my own story that I would need to back up a few years before that to tell you the whole thing. But and I'm sure we'll get there. But anyways, there were ranchers crying on the news because not because they lost a massive amount of money, because some of them probably had insurance and they were going to be fine financially, but they lost cows that they had spent years raising and that they had developed an actual relationship with. They know that cow's number. They know the mom of that cow, and they know whether that cow was bred with AI or artificial insemination, and they know whether that cow was conceived by a bull, and they can probably tell you pretty close to when on what day that cow was born. And so these people had a relationship with those cows and generations of those cows, and they lost them. Some people lost 75, 80, 90% of their herd in one day, and it was an emotional time to be in western South Dakota.
And with the in that emotion part, like you said, isn't just based on the fact that there's a business element or a financial value, but they were there probably from the time that calf was born, and they were and they've seen him reared up, and they've fed them, and they've taken care of him. And I feel a little bit of a kinship to that, as I've seen it in the hunting world, where now granted it's ultimately to harvest them, and that's a word that we like to use, that we know what that means in terms of bringing them to the table. But there is that circle of life aspect to it. There definitely seems to be an element that ranching and farming and things like of that nature tends to have with it. Is that something that always appealed to you, like on a personal level, that you even though you grew up in it, did you have a chance to go a different direction, or is that just always what you wanted to do and there just really wasn't a lot of room for anything else?
No, it was not something that always appealed to me. In fact, with both of my parents working town jobs, I kind of resented the cow herd before I was probably, 25 or so. It took all our weekends. My parents worked in town, and so on the weekends is when we did the ranch work, aside from keeping everything fed, which was done every day. But on the weekends was when we did the ranch work, and so we didn't get weekends like I wanted to do, and I wanted to go and go to the lake and go shopping and go to Rapid City, South Dakota, and go on four-wheeler rides and different things like that, like I saw my friends from town doing, and we didn't get to do that. And so I resented them for that. And the interesting story of how I went from there, really, all the way through high school, that was my attitude. And I loved living in Waukesha, Wisconsin. It's 10 minutes west of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's an hour and a half or so, depending on traffic, north of Chicago. I loved it. I loved the city. But I distinctly remember, and I think this was the seed that was planted that caused me to want to be here for the rest of my life. I distinctly remember getting out of my car one time on a drive back, and it might have just been the stank of a 19-year-old boy driving 13 hours straight to see his girlfriend. But I got out of my car, and I distinctly remember smelling the western South Dakota air and smelling the sweetness of it and just how clean and fresh the air smelled, and thinking, oh, this is definitely not Milwaukee. This is different. This is clean. This is fresh air. This is the outdoors, and it's in a sense unadulterated. And so that was kind of the seed. And I think some more water, or what caused that seed to really grow, was really that Atlas storm and seeing the relationship that these guys had with their cows. Because because I was away at a town job, being a pastor for 11 years to this day when we're recording this, I've been a pastor for 11 years. So I was able to choose what days I wanted to be involved. And so I got involved in calving my dad's heifers, or helping him calve out those cows that were having their first calf, or known as a first calf heifer. I got involved in that. And I got involved in the brandings, which is akin to Thanksgiving or Christmas in western South Dakota, where people put on this massive feast and have a bunch of people over, and you work to brand the calves that were born that spring. And so I got involved in those points when I wanted to, but really saw that desire to be involved on a daily basis kind of grow up around the time of that Atlas blizzard. And I just saw that there's more going on here than just people making money. There's a relationship with these animals, and there is a care, and as you said, a harvesting. There's a stewardship of these animals that goes into it, and other things have contributed to that, but those two experiences specifically really led me down a path to where I am today, where I own 10 of my own cows officially, and I work 2.5 days a week with my dad on the ranch and doing the ranching tasks, and then I work 2.5 days a week here at the church as a youth and associate pastor.
So a couple of things may stand out to me when you say that. One is, I wonder what kind of role your faith has played in all that, in terms of how did that feed your desire to do that, and how that played a role. And then the other side of it is the fact that it's work. It's real work. It's hard work. I remember we just had that cat. We had that steer for maybe 8 or 9 months, and even the pigs that we helped my daughter raise. Now look, we're suburbs and run up to the high school where the barn is, but it was every day, and it was twice a day, and we didn't have a day off, and tending animals doesn't take a vacation. There's no spring break. There's no holidays and the rest of that, regardless. And is that in line with what you've seen? And then how do you, like I said, in terms of that trade-off, in terms of those two areas, kind of talk a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I guess the answer to the first question there, I think, is about my faith. I guess I just see God as sovereign. God is in control, and He has faithfully been leading me and moving me in this direction. And I'm kind of to the point right now where I guess I'd preach for free if I could afford to. You know, if there was some other way for me to supplement the rest of that income, I would continue to preach as long as I need to. God has really developed a love in my heart for the local church, or specifically the rural church, those churches that either have pastors that don't get breaks from preaching because they're the only one within 50 miles that will not can, but will step behind the pulpit, or those rural churches that don't have a pastor. And most of those rural churches honestly could support a pastor, but they just can't find somebody willing to live 50 miles from a Walmart, you know, and for some of those communities, that's close. 50 miles would be a closer trip to town than they are actually having. So I guess just knowing that God's sovereign and He's been leading me and developing these things. And as I become aware of needs and able to meet those needs, seeing those opportunities. So I think that's mostly the answer to that question. And then was the second part about that was work?
It's hard work. I mean, it's not these, I can remember, you know, getting kicked by a steer, getting run into by a steer, you know, they're tough. And they're if like you said, a 700-pound animal, when they step on you, you know, or throw you to the ground, they can do that or swing their head. I remember getting lit up. I had that steer drug me. I remember I was trying to get my daughter, she had the halter on when we first had him, and this guy suggested, and I didn't know what I was doing. Like I said, we walk out in the main alleyway there of the barn, and this was a brand new steer, and it's, you know, it's a Hereford steer, and so it's not small, and definitely not, it's definitely bigger than I am. And so this thing takes off and literally starts running down the middle of this, and my daughter is in between me and the steer. She's holding on to it, and I'm holding on to it next to her, and I'm yelling at her, "Hey, let go!" And this thing, and I'm screaming, "Let go!" She finally lets go, because it's running and it's starting to make a beeline for the gate or for the fence line on the side, and she was going to be between me and this steer, and then she let go, and then it was just me and the steer, and I'm holding on to this thing for dear life, because all I could think of is, if I let go, this thing is, we're never going to get it back in the pen, and you know how that feeling goes. Better than I do, and it threw me all over that barn like I was nothing, and it was a very humbling experience. And so, but that's an extreme, but it's still having to fight that and deal with that, and the, you know, the hay bales and the food and the all the things that go with it, all that, it's real, real work, and it's every day, all day. It's kind of what I was getting at, and maybe talk a little bit about, and that's just my little example. What is it like when you have 10 and you have all this land and you have all this responsibility? What's, give us kind of the bigger version of that story.
Yeah. Well, and that's just it. You know, you don't get to take a day off from feeding your cows necessarily. You know, if you're going to do that, you got to feed them twice as much the day before. But if you try to feed them more than 3 days worth of food, they're going to waste most of it and not use it. So, and this is specifically winter feeding, and that's when most of the labor comes into a cow herd as far as getting them fed. Now, there's lots of labor throughout every season, but winter feeding specifically, there's labor involved in getting them fed every day or every other day or every third day. But beyond that, like I said, they waste a lot of that. And so that animal needs to eat. Maybe you've seen the social media postings, if you're cold, they're cold, bring them inside, you know, yes. That kind of an idea. if you're hungry, they're hungry, right? And a cow needs to eat, a 1,200-pound cow needs to eat 30 pounds or so of food a day, of hay or grass or something, needs to eat 30 pounds every day. And so you've got to figure out a way to deliver. And some of these guys out here are dealing with herds of 200, 300, 400 head, and they've got to figure out a way to deliver 30 pounds every day to every one of those cows. And you can't skip a day because they will break the fence down. They will lose body condition, which is kind of their fat reserves. They will lose their calf if they get too drastically thin and malnourished and all those things. So you know, if you're hungry, they're hungry. You got to feed them, and that you don't get to take a day off.
And not only that, but when they get sick, you have to take care of them, right? And so maybe talk a little bit about that process of how it is, because there's a little bit, as you mentioned before we started talking, you know, there is that business element to it in terms of a responsibility around harvesting. And so, as you mentioned, if the fat gets depleted, does that have an effect on the quality of meat? Is it that easy? I know obviously there's an emotional attachment, but how do you balance the emotional side with the business side a little bit?
As far as the fat content and the taste of the meat, that's really what you're shooting for. I have a friend that his business is, he travels around and he ultrasounds live beef carcasses. And he ultrasounds them specifically for the size of their ribeye steak. He can tell with an ultrasound tool how big that ribeye steak is going to be. And actually what he's doing is he's ultrasounding seed stock, which is the people that are raising the bulls that ranchers like me go and buy to breed their cows. So he's ultrasounding seed stock and saying this bull has this size ribeye, and he's probably going to throw a calf if he's bred to a comparable cow with this size of a ribeye. And so that kind of determines what you can sell that bull for. And so, you know, but that what he's really measuring is size and then marbling. What is the marbling? And marbling, I'm sure anybody who's thrown a grill on a steak is familiar with marbling. It's just those white streaks of fat in your ribeye steak that give it all the flavor. That's what gives it that flavor that makes it beef. It's what's for dinner, you know? And so, yeah, I wish I had, as a podcaster, I wish I had the voice of Sam Elliott, but I don't. Or Matthew McConaughey, I guess, now is the 21st century Sam Elliott. But
I'd still go Sam. If I could change my voice to sound like anybody, it'd be Sam Elliott, because I listen to myself talk and I'm just like, oh my gosh. But yeah. Yeah, I wish I looked like him, talked like him, all that good stuff.
I probably would lean more to the Sam Elliott side of the spectrum than I would Matthew McDreamy, too. So,
although he's a Texas boy and he's awful popular down here, so I get that too. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Does it matter? Is he popular with Aggies fans? He's a Longhorn, right? Is he popular with Aggies fans?
A little cross culture. So yeah, if you're not in Texas or if you're not familiar with the University of Texas and Texas A&M, are definitely two rival schools down here in the rivalry doesn't really stop. And the Aggie side, which you probably know, is heavy on the agriculture and mechanical side in terms of engineering. And so yeah, so there's always that friendly banter, but in the end, if the Texas flag is somewhere, we tend to rally around it and support you no matter what, typically. So yeah, we love Matthew, and even though he doesn't always wear, you know, doesn't wear maroon, and he always wears burnt orange, and it's all good for sure.
good. I appreciate that insight.
But I'm definitely not a Longhorn fan or an Aggie fan. I got friends of mine that are, and it's, you know, the pride runs deep on both sides, that's for sure. So cool. So you mentioned ultrasound, and so that's an example of kind of modern technology, obviously, that we have not had. How long has that been around?
I don't know about the carcass ultrasounding. This guy's the only guy I know that does it. I'm sure there are other people doing it. He's just the only one I know personally that does it. And he travels quite a ways. I think he's in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Nebraska, you know, kind of the states that touch South Dakota, Iowa. I don't know if he covers all those states, but I know he's in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and some of those others. So anyways, carcass ultrasounding, I'm not sure how long they've been doing that, but ultrasounding for pregnancy, which is basically if you've been to a first trimester ultrasound for a lady in your life, it would be a lot like that. Kind of the same method as a first semester ultrasound. And I suppose the first time that I remember us employing that technique with our cows was probably between 10 and 15 years ago. We started ultrasounding our cows rather than the old-fashioned shoulder height or shoulder length plastic glove and the arm up the rectum, which is a rectal palpate method. That was how we used to do it. And we we don't do it that way anymore. We bring in the ultrasound for a few different reasons.
Well, I'm sure everybody's happy about that advancement in technology.
Yeah. It didn't make any difference to me. I was in the back of the chute pushing cows up to the actual chute where the rectal palpation was taking place. But, yeah, I'm sure those guys are happy that it's changed. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were talking about a guy that they knew that had chutes on both sides of him, and he had a glove on both arms, and he would go back and forth and palpate all day long that way and just run through a bunch of cows. Now, his accuracy was questionable, and that was why he came up in the conversation. But it was just, you know, kind of a little glimpse into the culture that we are a part of here.
It must be a very interesting conversation in terms of how you train for that and what you're how to transfer the knowledge and how you become good at that. This may sound like a really bad joke, but are they the butt of most jokes, those kind of guys?
they tend to have a lot of respect if they're good at it, honestly. Like, I was talking to my dad the other day, and he's like, generally, when I've done it and the calf is sucking my thumb from inside the womb, I know that cow's bred. But other than that, my accuracy isn't so great. Which has actually happened. That's not an exaggeration.
That's very interesting. So what kind of what other technologies are out there? That's a very interesting use of ultrasound. And so from a day-to-day ranching standpoint, how much is technology and even the internet or smartphones or GPS or drones, has any of that stuff kind of made its way into the cattle ranching business?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, like all sectors of technology, there are early adopters and there are those who are not necessarily suspicious or whatever of new technology. They just haven't taken the time to learn it, to implement it. One of the classes I went to, a family there, and actually it was one of the episodes of my podcast, they were talking about how they use Google Earth to plan their grazing. I saw a video, I think it was on Twitter or Facebook the other day, of a guy using drones to check his cows, and I think he was actually moving them with his cow, or moving cows with his drone. And then the farming side, which I'm not very familiar with at all, but the farming side, they've got incredible amounts of technology down to essentially self-driving tractors and tractors that will make a turn at the end of a field. And so technology has been really implemented there on a large scale. A lot of technology has been implemented in feeding of cows, how you feed cows and kind of the tools as far as mixing a good ration for them to gain well and gain at a healthy pace. A lot of technology has been used to determine what the best ration is for a cow. A lot of those guys, a lot of technology has gone into that, you know, just with basically diet science and nutrition science and some of those things, a lot of advancements that way as far as how you can best feed that cow that in a way that is most healthy for her, that's going to produce the most milk, that's going to produce, you know, whatever it is you're looking to do with a cow through her nutrition. Basically, you can do that if you're willing to take the time to learn what they need.
So around technology and those kind of advancements, we alluded to it a little bit in the beginning, and it's something that usually comes up, but you'll see in the meat market in the grocery store that, you know, grass-fed beef and open-range beef, and you know, maybe that's more on the chicken side, but definitely some of these ideas around all-natural and antibiotic-free. When you hear that, I mean, are those kind of buzzwords? Do they really mean something? What really goes on your end around that kind of stuff? And what would you want to say kind of out to the world in that sense of, speaking, I don't want to say counter to that, but is it an urban legend? Is it myth? Is it drive you nuts? Is it a healthy concern for people? What would you say about that kind of thing?
No, I think that more and more I have come to be more sympathetic to those lines of thinking, I guess, is kind of the best way I can put that as far as grass-fed and all-natural and some of those different things. I think a lot of the need for supplementation and antibiotics and those kinds of things, and this is a blanket statement that I'm going to qualify by saying it's not every situation, but a lot of the need for supplementation and antibiotics has come from a mismanagement of grass resources, of the cow herd in general. And if we were managing the cow herd a little bit differently, some of those antibiotics might not be as necessary as they were. or as they are in some of the more traditionally managed herds. So I think that those are things that people are waking up to more and more. There's kind of a revolution within the beef industry of different ways of thinking about a lot of these different things. And so as far as grass-fed beef, you know, when I first heard of grass-fed beef, I kind of said, well, yeah, all cows are grass-fed, but how are they finished? And that really is the issue. You know, a lot of those cows will be, because grass is the cheapest feed you've got. And ultimately, to finish them quickly, to get them to a finishing weight, which is the weight at which they are slaughtered and butchered and all those things, to get them to a finishing weight, the fastest way to do it is to pour the corn to them and other things mixed in with that. You can't give them just straight corn, or you have to at least break them into eating corn, because their gut is designed to digest grass. They are a ruminant animal. And so their gut is designed to digest grass. And so you have to break them into that corn and then finish them out with the corn. And I don't know that anybody ever gets to only feeding corn at the end of the steer's time in the feedlot. But, you know, so how are they finished is really the question. And so we have seen that. The market wake up to that. Well, these people are just pulling the wool over our eyes and say, yeah, that cow's eating grass at some point in his life. And now we're seeing in the market grass finished beef, which is those that are actually finishing those cows with a forage based diet.
Is that ideal? I mean, I've never heard of that. So this is great. So in terms of, and when you say finish, it's because you're really preparing them to go to market so you can sell them. And is that finish around just getting the most weight you can for it from a business standpoint, or is there any other element to the finishing process?
I think it's just simple economics. You know, it's what does the market demand, and you've got to rise up and meet that supply. You know, and so most people aren't conscientious about what they're eating, and so the market is not demanding anything different than what we have been providing for a long time. But how it typically works, and this is a little bit unique in the cow industry, is that the rancher who was there when the calf was born will not be there when the calf is slaughtered. And what I mean by that is that he's not the one loading it on a truck to go to the slaughterhouse. Usually he'll load it on the truck about 7 months or 8 months after it's born, and it will go to a sale barn. And from the sale barn, it will go to Kansas, or it will go to Oklahoma, Nebraska, Iowa, you know, some of those other states, but those are the major feedlot states. It'll go to a feedlot and it'll get finished. So it'll be taken from 700 pounds or so up to 1,200 pounds. And 1,200 pounds is kind of slaughter weight that you shoot for on those yearlings or those young animals. And so we kind of traditionally, especially in Western South Dakota, we haven't had a relationship with those animals that we have had born into our herd in 1 year. We haven't had a relationship with them beyond the fall of the next year. Most cattle ranches around here are calving in somewhere between January and March or April, and they will raise those calves that are born in January or March or April up until September, October, November, and then they will sell those calves and they won't see them again. Now, in the poultry industry, those people are probably loading those chickens on the truck. Now, it's a lot faster process, but those producers are loading those chickens on the truck that they're going to go straight to the slaughterhouse. And I think it's similar in the pig industry. Now, if I'm speaking out of turn, you can hit me up at YP Clay Connery on Twitter and tell me that I'm speaking out of turn. But a lot of the other sectors of agriculture, that producer has a relationship with that meat until it's leaving to be slaughtered, and that's not the way it is typically in the ranching industry.
And then from an overall management standpoint, you really have no idea even where that calf will end up, and then even after that, where the actual meat will end up, in a supermarket somewhere or at a steakhouse. Do you have any, or do you?
You know, as far as where the meat's going to end up, most of the premium quality meats that you're going to get your hands on as far as a steak or some of those things are going to be a younger animal. But you have no idea where in the country it's going to end up. A lot of the ground meat that you get is probably an older animal. Now, those are both generalizations. So take them for what they're worth, but that's kind of the way those things happen. A lot of a younger animal will get ground, but most of the steak that you eat is going to come from a younger animal, and most and not very many of the steaks that you eat are going to come from an older animal. We don't have that retained ownership is kind of the way it's talked about around here. We don't have that relationship a lot of times in our produce or in our production businesses.
So a couple of questions around that, because I'm curious now. Now, is there an overall standard as being part of the, I guess, the beef industry, if that's correct? Is there an overall standard that you guys adhere to as a collective so that it maintains a certain qualitative aspect across the board, no matter where the cow, the calf or the cattle comes from? And then how much of it do you ever get to individualize and sell directly to somebody? Like, is, can a person just come to your ranch and buy a calf?
The standard question is generally handled by a breed, by the breed itself. So, like, there's the Angus Association, specifically the Black Angus and the Red Angus Association. There's the Hereford Association. There's the Charolais Association. There's as many as you can think of. Maynon Jew, if you want to really fancy it, the Wagyu Beef Association. Oh, yeah, you know, there's all these different breeds of cows, and so each one of them generally has their own association, and each one of those association kind of does its best to market its product to the American public in a way that is most attractive to them. And going along with that, they are supposed to have standards, or they would say that we have standards that make our breed better than another breed. And so come to us to get your steaks and your T-bones and your ribeyes, because our standards mean that our breed is going to be better than the next breed. And so that it's kind of a marketing thing that goes along with that. So that's kind of how that works as far as the quality assurance. Now, there's some wide sweeping quality assurance things going on in the beef industry. BQA, it's called, Beef Quality Assurance, is something that's being adopted by a lot of producers, and that is a lot around how those cattle are handled, but also how they're fed and some of those different things, and if antibiotics are given, where they are injected, so that they are injected as close to the bloodstream as possible and not directly into the muscular part of the animal that's going to become a beef product that will be consumed by an end consumer. So I think, does that answer that first question?
Yeah,
I'll go to the direct marketing question next. If it does.
No, so as an aside question, what breed of cattle do you raise?
Probably 95% of my dad's herd is Angus, and then there's a couple of Hereford cows in the herd, and then I think all of his bulls at this point are Angus. And there's some advantages to breeding, crossbreeding herds or crossbreeding breeds of cow, that will give you some advantages as far as the durability or how well that animal, the hardiness of the animal itself, and also in the way that that animal will gain weight and some of those things. So there's lots of different crossbreeds that you can, and actually I was just recording a podcast before I came on here with a guy that has a different crossbreed than we have used, but he's having success with it.
And so to that, did you choose Angus because it was just you think it's the best, or is it more regional because it's what survives, or is it what played that part in choosing that type of cattle?
The market decided for me. You know, that's just what is in high demand. I'm a capitalist, and I'm unapologetic about that, and I chose the most desirable animal, the most marketable, I should say, most marketable animal that I could.
So as an aside question to that, another one is because everybody hears Black Angus. I mean, I'm a steak lover. I'm, like I said, I grew up in Texas. It's pretty much what we're given that before we're given actual baby food down here. And is Black Angus, is it the best? Maybe this is the
best. Of course.
Maybe,
of course.
Okay, so let me ask you another question, because that's kind of a loaded question now that I think about it. What other, if you can't get Black Angus, which is the best, obviously, what's your second favorite?
A Black Angus crossbred with a Hereford.
Perfect. Love it.
No, I, you know, like there's some Japanese breeds that have started to be introduced into America. That one of them I mentioned earlier was the Wagyu breed.
Oh, yeah.
W-A-G-Y-U. Yep. Yeah, Wagyu. Maybe I'm spelling that wrong. I don't know. I was just introduced to it a while ago, but they're really known for their marbling. And then there's some other Japanese breeds that are also being introduced, and some people are having some really good success with. And so it all comes down to the end product and what does that marbling look like and those things. And the Angus beef does marble well. You know, it is legitimately high marbling in the way that those animals put on fat.
So is that ribeye, is that marbled beef, is that kind of your favorite? Or are you a filet mignon fan, or does it, or sirloin or T-bone? Or
yeah, when I was in high school, hell yeah, yep. No, I honestly, like, I could probably count on, I don't know, very few meals growing up did not have beef in them. And, yeah, I mean, if they didn't have beef, they had tuna, because chicken was expensive and my dad wouldn't eat it. So, but we could, you know, we could produce that beef cheaper, and it would be an animal, generally an animal that wasn't going to market well, that we would finish ourselves and then take to slaughter. So I grew up eating lots and lots of beef. So when I was in high school, I enjoyed New York strip because it sounded fancy. And then after college, I had a little bit of a fling with a T-bone because it had the tender side, the sirloin side. And then when I became a man, as the Apostle Paul would say, I switched to eating ribeyes. So the ribeye is my steak of choice. And if I'm really feeling fancy, I'll get me a bone-in ribeye.
So here's the ultimate question for steak lovers out there. And how do you have your steak cooked?
Oh, medium rare. Yeah. I like it to be warm all the way through. That's kind of my only standard.
Oh, yeah. Look, I love my wife, and she'll be mad at me for saying this, but I convince her she should just eat a hockey puck instead. She's the well-done person, just wants, you know, literally no red, no anything. And it just dries it out, and I'm just, because I'm a rare to medium rare kind of guy. So good answer, good answer. And, you know, as we're going along here, one of the things I kept thinking about, so back to the technology side, what made you, because I think it's such a unique thing. We talked about technology earlier in terms of how people use it, and you started a podcast. So what I'd like to kind of end on that in terms of what made you start a podcast around the cattle industry, and how's that been received, and what's it like for other people? Because I know some of the episodes that I listen to, very well done, and I love the human side of it. I loved all those different parts of it, the practical side of it. But are you seeing a lot of great feedback from that? And then what was the catalyst for you starting that?
So as far as the catalyst, my wife and I, kind of as we have both had this desire to be involved in the ranching industry on more than just a cursory basis, we decided to be involved. And my dad is getting ready to transition out, which he's by ranching industry standards, he's young to even think about that. But anyways, so he knew that that was kind of his desire. And so he said, we should send you to a continuing education course. And so we went to a continuing education course called the High Plains Ranch Practicum, put on by the University of Wyoming and the University of Nebraska Extension Agencies. And one of the instructors in that class, it was 2 days a month over the course of 4 months. And one of the instructors in that class, who is kind of a podcast listener himself, said, you know, one of you guys needs to start a podcast. And I'm like, well, I've worked in a church for 11 years. I know how to, you know, maintain a website, and I know how to upload content to the internet, and I know how to record audio, and I know how to edit audio. So I'm like, I could probably do that. But as most things, it's like, I don't really have time to do that. And then, so every class period, he mentioned that. And so after the third class period of him mentioning that, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it. And so I put it together and I recorded a few episodes, and I got back to the last class period, and I announced it to the class that I'd started this podcast. And just basically my whole motivation, because this class that I went to was a paradigm buster as far as the practices that they were encouraging us to adopt, and specifically the practices as it relates to grazing and grazing that cow as long as possible. And there are people who are grazing those cows essentially year round, which is hard when you think about snow cover and you think about frozen water and you think about all the challenges that go with that. And then they talked about how you could transition to doing that. And so that really piqued my interest of a new out-of-the-box way of doing things, or different, maybe not new, but an out-of-the-box way of doing things. And so I decided I wanted to start a podcast, and I wanted to give producers a platform to share paradigm-challenging practices. And so that was what I I did, and I've been able to find ranchers. I've been able to find kind of industry experts, so to speak, to interview and to talk about. And one of the benefits that I have is that my dad is essentially my target audience. And so I've had to show him how to get a podcast onto his phone. But he's a regular listener, and I get to ask for feedback, and I get to talk to him about how, you know, what he thinks about it, and get feedback from him on those episodes. And so that's been a really good opportunity. As far as the reception has been concerned, you know, podcasting can be kind of a lonely endeavor. You know, you don't get a lot of feedback all the time. You know, you see the downloads come through, and those numbers are exciting, especially when you're first starting out like I am. You don't get a lot of feedback. And, you know, the most exciting stuff is people liking the Facebook page that you didn't know before you created the Facebook page, or people sending you reviews through iTunes that you didn't know before the podcast started, or that you still don't know. So those are some of the things that I guess I've looked at as far as how well it's been received and those things. And I'm having a whole ton of fun doing it. So really that's the bottom line, is how much fun am I having doing it, and will I continue to do it? And because I'm still having fun, I'm going to continue to do it.
In addition to be fun, you're specifically, there is some technical and some very savvy information that people can take into their own industry. And it seems to have that. So in terms of that, how cattle ranching, obviously through the Midwest, I know we have it here in Texas, obviously. It's still a very large industry.
And a couple
even,
of things.
And even internationally, too. You mentioned Japan and.
Oh, yeah.
Other, I mean, the UK or Europe, they have it. I mean, it hasn't gone anywhere for sure.
Yeah, I'd really like to talk to some of the people in Europe about, you know, what does a ranch in Europe look like? Because they're different. You know, they're smaller. They're just different in the way they operate. You know, another country that is huge as far as production of beef animals is Argentina. Argentina produces a whole ton, and they're really famous for their cowboys and how good those cowboys are, you know, and that cowboy lifestyle and some of that stuff. So, you know, it's just a really fascinating deal. Just to illustrate the importance of agriculture in the Midwest or in the West, in South Dakota, there are five sectors of agriculture. There's beef, there's swine or hogs or pigs, there's chickens or poultry in general, I guess. There's dairy and there's sheep, I think, are the five that I'm looking at. Or farming. So anyway, those five, each one of them individually brings more money or more GDP to the state of South Dakota than the second largest moneymaker, which is tourism. And if you think about that, we've got the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. Right. We've got pheasant hunting. We've got
Deadwood. Deadwood's out there.
Deadwood, yeah. Yep, and Mount Rushmore, you know. So Deadwood, Sturgis, pheasant hunting, and Mount Rushmore are all tourism income, right? Each one of the individual five sectors of agriculture brings more money to the state of South Dakota individually than tourism does. And so that kind of just tells you about the importance of agriculture in our state. And the probably even a better illustration of that is, are you familiar with the oil boom in North Dakota?
Yes, I am.
And maybe a lot of people are. It's called the Bakken oil field.
Oh, yeah.
There's the Three Forks shale and different formations that they're finding, and technology has allowed them to harvest that in a lot more efficient way. And so anyways, that boom, I think, started somewhere around 2008, 2009, and it peaked in 2014. And you just think about all the money and all the barrels of oil that they were pulling out of the ground. 2014 was the only year that oil brought more money to the state of North Dakota than agriculture. That blew my mind. I can understand that tourism is second to each one of the five sectors of agriculture in South Dakota, but that oil was second for all those years to agriculture in North Dakota was pretty mind-blowing to me.
No, it is. And I spent 16 years in oil and gas. So before I started my company, that's completely different. But I used to work for Schlumberger on the upstream side. So I'm very familiar with Bakken. I'm very familiar with horizontal drilling and fracking and all that stuff. And yeah, it's been revolutionary for us. And there's a lot of money in it. But it also gives you an idea, as you said, as to how much money and value is in the beef industry and in agriculture and farming and cattle ranching. So we talked about the podcast side and what that's been like for you. So, and if we could ever, if anybody out there is listening that has and knows somebody somewhere in the UK or in Argentina or in Japan somewhere, if this could ever get out to there and be used in that capacity to get somebody in contact with him, I think it'd be great. I think it'd be great to have him get in contact with you and do that. And that's one of the beautiful things about podcasting is the ability to bring those worlds together. And you can be, Clay's in South Dakota, I'm down in Houston, we're having this podcast, and somebody in Japan or in the UK or somewhere in the world can listen to it. And you can even connect with those people. I'm having people come on here in the future. I'm working on that in terms of there's a guy I have out in Latvia that I'm getting ready to connect with and in the UK and different places. And so it brings the world together. And so along those lines, and I don't want to get political or don't want to get too much of a I want to do that, but I definitely want to throw a little light on the fact that you mentioned earlier, way back, you used the phrase flyover state. That San Diego is a South Dakota is a
SD.
Right. I'm sorry.
I used to describe myself as from Western SD, yeah. And then I saw somebody describing San Diego as SD. I'm like, now I have to spell it all out. Western, yeah. South Dakota.
No, and when I was reading that earlier on my notes, because I spent 4 years there when I was in the Navy, and so I know San Diego, and so I apologize. No, South Dakota, and. You know, we hear that, and that was a big buzzword in the recent election, and we'd be doing a disservice a little bit if we didn't mention that. And you mentioned how you're being in that quote-unquote flyover state, as you mentioned. It's isolated anyway. It's out in the middle of nowhere. It's definitely a different world, a different culture. So if somebody's listening to this, it's sitting in a cafe in Los Angeles or is in the big cities in this country, I mean, what would you want to say around culture and differences, especially at this time of our country, and it's part of the motivation why I wanted to put this out there, because it seems to me that there's a lot more commonality while there are differences. And as you know, having somebody come in from the city into a ranch would be a lot of fun because they'd be completely out of their element. But all that aside, if you were to throw something out there in terms of those on the east or west coast, or that may be in blue states and in have no idea what it's like to raise cattle or ride a horse or drive a truck or any of the rest of these things that we tend to put in that area. Was there anything you'd want to say?
You know, I think that we're doing our best to provide you with best quality, most humanely raised animal that we can. You know, and we love these animals, and we're doing our best to take care of them from birth through when they end up on your plate to see that they are as comfortable and as happy as they can. Because if they're uncomfortable and they're unhappy, then they're not going to gain weight and they're not going to be productive animals. And so we're doing whatever we can to make sure that they're really taken care of, and really the BQA, the Beef Quality Assurance Program, and some of those things are in response to objections that were raised by, you know, the coasts, so to speak, the left coast and the east coast. You know, there was objections raised about how those animals were being handled, and we wanted to go out of our way and right down to the sorting stick, which is a tool that we use to sort cows in a corral. We've changed that to be a different shape and so that it doesn't even have to touch the animal. It just makes noise and they see it as a barrier and they want to go the opposite direction. And we try to, you know, I've got an episode releasing on Monday about low stress livestock handling, you know, and we're doing our best to raise these animals so that they're comfortable, they're well fed, they're well cared for. You know, Temple Grandin, I think I should bring up Temple Grandin. She's a fascinating lady. I think she's out of Colorado State University. I know she's in Colorado. I know she's at a university. I'm pretty sure it's Colorado State University. And she's actually autistic. And there's a great movie about her. I think it's Grandin is the name of, or Temple is the name of the movie. And she is a lot about talking about respect for the animal from the time it's born till the time it's slaughtered. You know, if we're going to eat them, we should respect them and we should take care of them and we should do the best to make sure that they're comfortable and happy all the way through. And so, you know, if you want to look up, there's that movie is really good. It's basically a docudrama on her life and how she came to draw comfort in her autism from a certain place in her house and how that allowed her to identify with cows, as strange as it may seem, and how she has revolutionized really the cattle handling side of the beef production industry. And a lot of, you know, our own systems are developed kind of in line with what she would say at our own personal ranch are developed in line with what she would say are some best practices. And she's still around and she's still giving lectures, and it's just a really fascinating thing. But, you know, we're doing our best out here to provide you with a high quality product that has been raised in a humane way and that was happy every day of its life.
So to that, one of the things that we typically do as part of this podcast is we ask our listeners and kind of challenge them to maybe have a conversation out with somebody that they know. Well, obviously around this subject, if you're living in a city or a suburb, it's going to be very hard to find a cattle rancher. And so I would maybe take a little bit of a step in a different direction, and that is to invite you to listen to that episode. And I'm glad you mentioned that about this low stress. So by the time this episode comes out and you hear this, your episode drops, that one you said drops
Monday. Yep.
And I can guarantee you that our episode will drop after that. So you can go to the Working Cows podcast. And if you don't listen to any other episode, and there's a very good chance that some of the other ones are going to be very difficult to, you know, to find some commonality with it in terms of, you know, how you manage a herd and how you do the different practices and stuff like that. But maybe if you're wanting to know what's going on in that industry and how the humane aspect that's being brought into how cattle is being treated, and hear it from, again, bad joke, hear it from the horse's mouth, even though I know you don't raise horses, but in the spirit of that, to listen to what they're talking about and to have some confidence. And it's not about trying to change somebody from a vegetarian to somebody who's a meat eater or trying to say you have to eat meat. But if you're having that and you're curious about it, that may be a way to go out and listen to Clay's podcast and hear what he has to say and what other people are saying about it. So I put that out there to the audience.
That'll be at workingcows.net/12, the number 1212. Workingcows.net/12 is the episode number where you can listen to that episode. Another thing that I would say is that there are people, there's specifically a lady who wrote a book called Defending Beef, and she went from being a vegan, and I'm not trying to convert anybody, you know, to each his own. You're free to do whatever makes you happy. But she went from being a vegan to eating beef and actually defending the beef industry because she has woken up to this idea that beef and ruminant animals specifically are the best tool we have for stemming or for sequestering carbon. I'm not going to get into climate change, yes or no, but carbon is produced. We breathe it out. You know, cars produce it. Factories produce it. Carbon is produced. It's just a fact of modern life. And the best tool that we have for sequestering carbon, whether or not it needs to is a whole other debate, but the best tool that we have for sequestering carbon is actually our soil. And the best thing that we have, and you can look up guys like Alan Savory and Ian Mitchell and Andre Boysen, who has passed away, but Alan Savory and Ian Mitchell are still alive. Alan Savory actually has a TED Talk on this very subject. The best tool that we have for sequestering carbon, for increasing and maximizing soil health, is ruminant animals. When I talk about ruminant animals, I'm talking about cows, goats, sheep, you know, those kinds of animals. And because the way that they interact with the soil is the way they were designed to interact with the soil, and that soil responds really well to them pooping, peeing, and harvesting that grass resource. And so I think that these two worlds are getting closer together with the demand for grass-fed beef and people being tendency in our culture for people to want to be aware of where their food's coming from. I think those worlds are getting closer together, and I think it's a good thing for a lot of different reasons.
Well, amen. And what I'll do, I'll put those in my notes. So inside the show notes, I'll put something in there about the I'll find some information about Temple, and I'll do what I can to put that in the show notes. I'll also look at that book, the Defending Beef book, and then Alan Savory and Ian Mitchell I have written down. I'll have those TED Talks or anything I can find, and I'll work with you after we get done about putting that in our show notes. So those who are listening can go and check that out. And I think this has really been awesome to listen to you talk about it, because those are things that tie into all these, I think, bigger world issues that tend to divide us. That could there be an opportunity for the cattle industry to come up and play a role in that and how we can all work together. And I think that's a beautiful testament to that. So that's really good information.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to share it. It's just been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
No problem. So we're up against a $1.20, and one of these wonderful conversations that could keep going and going, and we'll talk a little bit after this, I'm sure. But as I always do, if you'd be so kind, Clay, I'm gonna wrap us up with a prayer, and we're going to end this episode.
Sure.
All right, buddy. So Heavenly Father, as we come to you, I just want to thank you so much for this opportunity to talk to Clay and ask that you continue to give him this wisdom and blessings and strength in terms of what he's doing, and let him know that what he's doing out there is valuable and what he's doing out there is appreciated by many. And that if and we just ask that you continue to help him and his family as they go through this, and just the service. It really becomes a bit of a service and a love and a compassion that you can hear in his voice for what he does with the animals. And if we can take any of this message out to the world and let them know that they're people just like the rest of us out there, and they do different jobs and they live in different parts of the country and do different things. And if we can use this opportunity to bridge a little bit more of that gap and bring people together in that sense, then I'd hope that you can be glorified in that. Thank you for our health as well. Thank you for this, just the chance to do all this. It's just such a humbling experience. And while it is a lot of fun, we hope that there's an opportunity to glorify you out there. And we just thank you for that. It's in your son's name that we pray. Amen. All right, buddy. Amen. Well, thank you so much for doing this. Please check out the notes. We changed. We have a new email address. It's Sean@thecometothetablepodcast.com. It'll be in the show notes. We're getting official now and all that kind of good stuff. And we asked it. And as Clay said earlier, it's great to hear back from you. If you hear something from this episode and you want to touch base with us, let us know. Yeah, we're just a couple of guys. Reach out to Clay. Reach out to myself. Something that moved you or something that spoke to you in this podcast. We want to hear from you. We're just regular people like you. We're not professionals. We're just doing this because we love it, and we hope this makes a difference and hopes that it brings some motivation, some inspiration to those that are out there listening. All right, we're going to sign off. Thank you again, buddy. I really appreciate it. This was wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right, thank you all. All right, God bless, and we're out.
This episode has been brought to you by Kamak Ranch Supply. Check out their website at kamakranchsupply.com. Here's the deal about Kamak Ranch Supply. When you call and ask them about a product, there's no blank pause on the other end of the line because they don't understand the product that you just asked them about. If they are selling it, they understand it because they are producers, and Gary Kamak himself, the owner of Kamak Ranch Supply, is a producer. So if you want answers about the products you're calling to ask about from producers, call Kamak Ranch Supply or check out their website at kamakranchsupply.com. If you want to check out the show notes page for this episode and check out some of the things that I mentioned there in my conversation with Sean McCoy on the Come to the Table podcast, please check out workingcows.net/21. Workingcows.net/21 is the show notes page for today, and I've got some resources there, some of the different producers and thinking people, talking heads, if you will, Alan Savory and Ian Mitchell Inns, and some of those will be linked, and their resources will be linked at workingcows.net/21. Again, next week, coming up on the show, we've got a discussion with a cooperative producer for Faro Cattle Company, Cody McDaniel from Montana, and talking about his move from Kansas to Montana. So we will see you next week for episode 22 of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.